You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although women are being encouraged to lean into their careers and ambitions, they comprise just over one quarter of the tech workforce. Elephant in the Valley, a new survey released last month, reveals that 60% of women who work at tech companies have reported unwanted sexual advances from colleagues or superiors. 39% of those women harassed did nothing because they thought it would have a negative impact on their careers. The study, co-authored by engineer and investor Trey Vassallo, looks at the issues facing over 200 women in the tech industry and invites others to share their stories anonymously. Trey Vassallo joins us now to discuss sexism in Silicon Valley, along with Rachel Sklar, a writer, tech entrepreneur, co-founder of The List, a network for professional women, and founder of Change the Ratio. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Trey, what prompted you to undertake this study?
So about a year ago, there was a very public case in Silicon Valley where Ellen Pao versus Kleiner Perkins, and I happened to be a witness that was subpoenaed to testify. And in that, I testified about a harassment experience that I had. And what was incredibly surprising to me was just the outpouring of support from women after I went through the testifying process. And what surprised me was just the number of women who said, first, thanks for sharing your story, but, you know, here's my story. And from what I could tell, it was well over half of these women who reached out. And I was just astonished.
Now, hasn't Ellen Pao lost that case?
Correct. Yes, that's right.
I guess I didn't read the study. The study focuses on five areas. What are they?
Sure. It's feedback and promotion, inclusion, unconscious bias, motherhood, and harassment and safety.
And you decided to choose women with at least 10 years of experience?
That's right. We wanted to survey a number of women who were at points in their career where they were actually in positions of power. So 25% of the women, actually 26% of the women we surveyed were executives in organizations, 11% were founders and entrepreneurs, and 11% were in venture. And so we didn't want people saying, well, that's, you know, women who were in positions or weren't very strong women. These are women who have worked their way to the tops of organizations and have experienced things that they shouldn't have to go through.
Were most of them in the Silicon Valley area?
Yes. So we did, you know, our goal was to basically take the temperature of what the environment that we're working in, and the group of us that put this survey together are in Silicon Valley. So the majority of folks, in fact, 91% of folks were in Silicon Valley.
Now, almost half of these women were in top positions. Were you surprised by their responses?
You know, once we started talking with folks anecdotally, it was very eye-opening. So when we got this data, it definitely supported the anecdotal evidence. But then when you take a step back and look at how high some of these numbers are, it is really shocking. And that's why we wanted to get this information out there so we could have some conversation.
Are you still asking women in the industry to share their experiences?
Absolutely. So we have a website, elephantinthevalley.com, and on that site we actually have some of this headline data and give women the opportunity to share their experiences in many different areas. And our hope is that we can take these anonymous data points and sort of put them into some sort of format so that folks can, you know, get a sense for what women are experiencing.
I suspect we have more than a few listeners who have stories to tell. And we invite them to call us.
And one participant.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Rachel, in 2010, you co-founded a tech company called The List. Can you identify with the issues that were raised in the survey?
Absolutely. Actually, in 2010, it was Change the Ratio, which was the sort of movement to change the ratio of the way women are funded, recognized, elevated in the tech industry. And the list was an outgrowth of that. But over and over again since that founding, and indeed it was the impetus for the founding, was the stubborn reality that women in the tech industry and in related industries are treated differently.
Than in other industries?
Well,
what makes it unique?
Sadly, Sadly, no. Well, I think one of the things about the tech industry is that it holds itself out to be a meritocracy. There's this notion within the tech industry, and certainly in 2010 when we founded, there was this real excitement about, you know, gosh darn it, anybody can go into their basement and build the next great company. Except, I mean, that was true, except when you actually looked at all the companies, they were pretty much uniformly founded by white men.
Named Steve.
Or Dave or Mike or and funded also by white men with boards as the companies grew that were comprised of white men. And so this meritocracy issue became this very stubborn sort of like assumption about the tech industry that actually was not at all the case. Unless you assume that white men are better than everyone else, which I do not assume.
Well, so you have also stressed the word white there. So would a woman of color be at a particular disadvantage in the tech industry?
A woman of color would be at a particular disadvantage, and many women have written about that. Erica Baker springs to mind as one who's written recently about that.
You worked as a lawyer at the start of your career, but left the legal profession. Was it easier for a woman to succeed there?
Institutional biases exist in institutions. That's why they're called institutional biases. I was not particularly interested in advancing in law, so I suspect I would have had a much more difficult time had I approached it sort of with the level of eager ambition as other things in my life. But there's no question I was very aware of those biases and you know, I had a lot of experiences with it. I certainly was treated well, but I definitely saw male colleagues being mentored much more. You see this across industry. These are not new stories. I mean, they may have been at the beginning of my career. This wasn't talked about as openly, but now, particularly with the advent of Lean In, it's sort of ushered in the era of everybody talking about this. And now that, you know, the term microaggressions is one that is bandied about, this wasn't happening a few years ago.
After you left the law profession, you became a founding editor at the Huffington Post. How did you become a tech entrepreneur?
You know, it depends on your definition of tech, right? One of the reasons that I started Change the Ratio was I began to see that it was a much more narrow definition being applied to women who were starting companies in the tech sector than men. So, for example, media companies that were like newsletter companies like Thrillist or that sort of thing, video companies, the men who were starting these companies were never questioned for their tech credentials. But when women were in the space, there was always, well, can you code? Like, are you an engineer? So there's always this assumption that for a woman to be a driving force, a participating force in tech, they ought to be able to code. But the fact is that it's a big industry, and there's a lot going on. There's many moving parts, and tons of founders do not themselves code. Change the Ratio started very much as a tech company, as a tech organization, because it focused on the tech industry and the wildly lopsided inequities in it.
We're talking with Rachel Sklar and Trey Fasalo about women in the tech industry. Trey, you're an engineer and investor. What has your career path been like? And can you identify with the responses of the women to your survey?
Sure. Well, starting off, I left school as an engineer and then developed products at a company called IDEO. And it was very male-dominated. But, you know, starting out early in your career, you know, my whole goal was I just wanted to design great products, put my head down, build awesome things. And the other thing that I think I learned early on was not to focus on what other people were saying, but to really be driven by an internal desire to do what I wanted to do. And that's what drove me to leave engineering to go to business school, where in my second year of business school, rather than listening to the crowd and jumping into a dot-com startup, I actually helped start a company that was very much rooted with physical devices. And I co-founded Good Technology, which was all about sort of syncing enterprise-class email to handhelds. And that's what launched me ultimately into my investing career, which started in 2003 at Kleiner Perkins, where I was for a decade.
Now, yesterday we talked about why there are so few African-American men or women in CEO positions in the Fortune 500. One of the strategies for many enterprising young black men and women is to become entrepreneurs. Is the same thing happening with women in the tech industry?
I'm definitely seeing more and more women becoming entrepreneurs, and so it's an exciting trend. Those entrepreneurs still need to get funded. And so I do think one of the choke points in the tech industry is that we still have an imbalance, a pretty significant imbalance of women in venture. And again, getting back to just unconscious bias, it's there. And so you have to be cognizant as you're evaluating all of these opportunities to go, am I evaluating this female entrepreneur on the same basis that I'm evaluating this male entrepreneur? And so I think the more women we have in venture, the more even that playing field is going to be.
Definitely. And from my perspective, I'm in New York, and we've seen just an explosion of companies founded by women. But invariably, it is more difficult for them to raise funding. I'm an advisor to a company called The Muse. They were in the Y Combinator class in spring 2011, I believe. Or winter 2011, and they had a product. They had a terrific company. They were showing growth, and they've spoken openly about this. That when the time came for fundraising, they experienced marked differences between the way the questions they were asked, the way they were treated, and the men in the group.
Did age factor into the responses to the survey?
You know, in order to have 10 years of experience, you're obviously going to be a little older. The 75% of the women surveyed were over 40.
84% of the women surveyed have been told that they were too aggressive, while 54% yep. have been told that they're too quiet. So I can't imagine 84% of men ever being criticized for being too aggressive or being too quiet, for that matter. What do you think that means? That's obviously based on people's preconceived notions?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this has been a point of a lot of conversation. And there was a wonderful anecdote that I love that said at Company X, we had a joke that there were only two reviews for women. You're either too reticent or too bossy, and there's no middle ground. And, you know, and I think that's very true. And the other thing that I think is interesting is that this character trait is not assessed at the same level for men.
And so, or at all, I would think.
Or at all, right. And so I think you actually raised exactly the right point. How many men are ever told they're too aggressive?
On MSNBC yesterday, Washington Post Associate Editor Bob Woodward commented on Hillary Clinton's lack of appeal by saying, "She shouts. There's something unrelaxed about the way she's communicating."
Yes, and Bernie Sanders is so mellifluous in how he speaks.
And Donald Trump is, and so is Ted Cruz.
You don't want to get me started, but Hillary Clinton is a really good example of a woman who, you know, who is just, it's just very difficult for her to walk that line. She has to walk such a fine line between showing strength and warmth and, you know, righteous anger. She can't be shrill. She can't be too pushy. You know, if she's being emotional, is she faking it? Is it authentic? It's amazing the standard that Hillary Clinton is held to compared to everybody else in the field for the presidency right now.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more with Rachel Sklar, who is the founder of Change the Ratio and co-founder of The List, a network for professional women, and Trey Vassallo, who has done a survey. She's an engineer and investor. She's done a survey that is called Elephant in the Valley. Stay with us for more. We are back with Trey Vassallo, who is an engineer and investor who has looked at the issues facing over 200 women in the tech industry and issued a report called Elephant in the Valley. And Rachel Sklar, who's a writer, tech entrepreneur, and founder of Change the Ratio and co-founder of The List. 75%, Trey, of the women that you surveyed have children. What did you learn about how family life and children affect women during job interviews?
Yeah, so interestingly, 75% of the women surveyed said they were asked about marital status, family life, or children during interviews. And those include, we got some quotes like, how do we know you're not going to run off and have a baby, or it's a good thing you don't have children yet. So even in the interviewing process, there's an interesting focus on how is family life going to affect you and your ability to do your job.
And one of the tweets on the Elephant in the Valley Twitter page reads, I'm a top performer, yet my supervisor asked why my husband didn't make enough of me to stay at home with my child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we also found out that 40% feel they need to speak less about their family life to be taken more seriously. And one of the anecdotes we got for that specific question was, I don't keep photos of my kids on my desk anymore.
Wow. This is just appalling. I'm reacting even though I shouldn't be surprised.
Right.
I am surprised.
We've all done it.
By this. Yep. Yes. Well, for the record, I have a 10-month-old daughter, and I am still capable of giving this interview.
What about maternity yeah. leave? How generous are people in the tech industry?
We didn't ask that specific question, but we did ask whether moms took shorter maternity leave because they were worried about their career. And what we learned was that 52% of moms did that. And then we also learned some interesting additional information. Like there was one particular theme that came up that said, while I was on maternity leave, a colleague tried to poach my team. And so, part of what we wanted to do in getting this data was also to create and illustrate very specific examples of what that data means. And when a woman is out on maternity leave, a lot of her, career and her projects are vulnerable. And so we want to make sure that it is known so that other folks can keep an eye open for this type of behavior.
And I think it's important, actually, to clarify that because, the notion of women being concerned with their career is often just assumed to mean that they're ambitious and hard charging, and maybe that's why they put off having children, and, they're interested in their own advancement. But in reality, it often comes down to concern about actually having the job when you get back, or coming back and having, and not being told in a few months, oh, it's not working out, because that happens all the time.
Yeah. And another anecdote that I thought was a great illustration was, I missed a bonus round for an entire year's work as I was out in December when it was assessed.
Ooh, that makes my blood boil.
Yeah, exactly. So it's things like that are just not logical, but need to get pointed out because those things have to be changed.
Trey, your survey also asked women about sexual harassment. Over one half, 60% of the women reported unwanted sexual advances. Was there any breakdown of the ways in which women were harassed? Was it from unwanted comments or was it more physical?
Well, we asked unwanted sexual advances. So what this is not is being asked out on a date. And so what we did learn was that 65% of women who had this experience had it from a supervisor. 50% of those had that experience more than once. And again, just to put some color around what that means for some of these women, one of the anecdotes said that the first time I traveled with a new CEO, he made an advance. I turned him down. After that, I was never asked to travel with him again. This impacted my ability to do my job.
And what about the fact that I would assume these women are less likely to report the harassment because their jobs might be at risk?
Yeah, retaliation is very real. And so when we asked about resolution, we learned that 39% did nothing because of exactly that. They thought it would negatively impact their career. Another 33% did nothing. Well, and these were, you could check multiple boxes, so these don't add to 100, but 33% did nothing because they didn't think that reporting would make a difference. And interestingly, when we asked of those who reported who were satisfied with the course of action, only 13% were actually satisfied with the ultimate course of action, which just further reinforces the system that we have set up does not help, it's not helpful to actually report these things.
I think just to go back to how we started, which was discussing the Kleiner Perkins Ellen Powell case, and you noted that she did not win that case, which is true. However, I don't think there is a person who was aware of the sort of ongoing elements of the case and the description of the workplace various indignities that she had to suffer through, who would say, gee, that sounds like a really awesome place to work, and that sounds totally normal. There were a lot of jaws on the floor, including my own, when the verdict came down about the POW case, because it seemed to me to be a workplace replete with microaggressions and very blatant bias against her on a gender basis.
Now, Trey, I know you can't comment on the case because it's still ongoing, but was it a difficult place to work at?
What I will talk about is I think none of these types of issues are easy to talk about for several really important reasons. Number one, retaliation is real. Number two, there are things like non-disparagement agreements that I believe the number was 29% of women in the survey had signed. And then the other big thing, which a legal friend
pointed out. Can you explain a non-disparagement agreement?
A non-disparagement agreement is just an agreement that says I will not talk negatively about a company, which means you can't publicly discuss.
Even if somebody sexually harasses you?
You cannot publicly discuss facts. And then the third thing is that arbitration actually means that a lot of incidences are handled, you know, outside the public eye, quietly and discreetly. And as one legal friend of mine likes to say, one public case does more to move society than, you know, thousands of arbitrations. And so, that is, because so much of this is handled behind closed doors, it's one of the reasons why we don't hear about the extent of this type of behavior in the workplace.
One woman wrote, a coworker had anger issues, especially toward women. I told my boss who blew me off. The coworker was eventually arrested at work for a violent episode.
Yikes.
Yeah. You know, we asked this question, how many women have felt afraid for their safety at work, and 30%.
Wow. I mean, these are high numbers. The thing that really struck me when I was looking at this survey was, again, I shouldn't be surprised, but I was, just because all of these numbers were just so much higher than basically any margin for error. And I knew there wasn't a margin for error because I've been a lightning rod for these stories to come to me now since I started Change the Ratio. But even so, just to see it starkly like that is really something.
My guests are Rachel Sklar, the founder of Change the Ratio, and Trey Vassallo, who's an engineer and investor who put together a survey called Elephant in the Valley. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Rachel, women writers are bombarded with vicious comments, abuse, and stalkers online, particularly if they write about sex and feminist issues. Journalist Amanda Hess has written, but these relentless messages are an assault on women's careers, their psychological bandwidth, and their freedom to live online. Should women just ignore the threats?
I mean, often people do. You know, you hear the phrase, don't read the comments. But she gets at the crux there. And when she says that there's a real psychological toll. Like, one of my jokes that isn't really that funny when you think about it, that I'd like to say about being a woman in this industry, in the tech and media industry, is that there's a whole other area of male privilege that people don't talk about, which is just the privilege to not have this stuff in your reply stream. It's the privilege to not have, you know, the sexist indignity of the day come up and then have to respond to it. It's the privilege to just not have to deal with any of this. It frees up a lot of time and a lot of psychological space. So I think, you know, it took a long time for tech companies to take online abuse seriously. Twitter, only in the last year, has really stepped up to improve their abuse reporting procedures. But report, block, and try to ignore. But at the same time, make some noise about the fact that this happens, because it's inexcusable, and it's even happening in the context of the election. We were talking before about Hillary Clinton there. You know, there is a phenomenon that has been written about. Rebecca Traister wrote about it in the New York Magazine. Michelle Goldberg wrote about it in, I believe, The Nation, about when women sort of express solidarity or approval of Hillary Clinton online, they get sort of swarmed by Bernie Sanders supporters saying, you know, they're called the Bernie Bros, saying, you know, trying to smack them down. And this is a documented phenomenon, and it happens everywhere.
In defense of Bernie Sanders, I just read a report, I think in Huffington Post, where you used to work, that suggests that perhaps some of those Bernie Bros are actually Hillary Clinton supporters trying to stir things up.
Who said that?
There was a report on that. It gets very complicated as to who is doing what, because there's so much anonymity.
Well,
on
when
the
someone
internet.
Has a hashtag feel the burn, like, I'm just going to assume that they're for Sanders. I think that's another way of invalidating the experience that women are reporting. If they're saying that they're saying something positive about Hillary, and then they're getting, you know, massive nasty online pushback for it, I'm with people who are pro Sanders, like, I think it's Occam's razor. I'm gonna assume that rightly or wrongly, that's not they're saying they're associated with the Sanders campaign, but that they are pro Sanders and anti Hillary, rather than some sort of nefarious thing that somehow makes it Hillary's fault all over again.
Along very different lines, Suzanne in Brooklyn has written in to ask, how is user experience affected by the fact that tech products are predominantly designed by men? Have you thought about that, Trey?
Well, you know, as a female investor, I have to say I see a lot of companies where, you know, I meet the company, and I inherently, because I'm the target customer, I get it really fast. And so I do think that, you know, when you have male founders and male investors, there's a tendency to invest in stuff that's more appealing to you personally. And a lot of founders, they invent companies that solve problems for them. And so this is another reason why I'm excited for more female entrepreneurs, and I'm excited for more female investors, because I do think there's tons and tons of opportunity that hasn't been uncovered around problems that inherently, you know, come to that part of the population.
Well, since women are using tech as much as men are, you would assume that the tech companies would want to have women there who would understand half of their customers.
You would assume that, and you know, user experience experts are starting to cotton to that. But I can remember, you know, when Siri came out, there were certain elements of Siri. But first of all, that it was Siri, the assistant, had the voice of a woman.
But she can be rather annoying, and whether she's a man or a woman.
Well, sure, but it was just, there was sort of like certain elements that were gendered. The most notable one, which has still been an issue, is that you have to work really hard to get Siri to find you any sort of abortion access. I remember that, like, the iPhone 6, I remember a lot of women saying, this is too big for my hand.
The abortion thing had to do with the fact that Siri goes to one site rather than another.
Right.
This,
like,
has to do with the fight between Google and, it's a whole other issue there.
Nonetheless, but this is, like, you know, it's just another example of the way that women, it's a microaggression, let's just call it that.
We blame Bill Gates for that one. The e-commerce site Etsy has been recognized for their recent efforts to attract 500% more female engineers. Etsy's engineering team is now 20 women to 90 men, or 500% more women than 2 years ago. How should tech companies recruit more female engineers for leadership roles when there are noticeably fewer women currently in leadership roles? Trey?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, this is not an impossible task, but you have to be focused on it. And it starts at the top. You have to set priorities. You have to make sure that your recruiters are looking for a balanced set of candidates. I met with one company recently who said, you know, we won't even let the recruiters show us a single candidate until they have an even balance from a gender standpoint. And once you get a couple of key female high-level employees, all of a sudden, there's a tipping point, and hiring starts to look a lot more balanced. So the key is to really start early.
Didn't Etsy offer grants for women to attend hacker school? I guess now it's called the Recurse Center, although I'm not sure what Recurse means.
Etsy made a very big point and a very strong show of committing to that diversity, and I think that is one of the ways in which you attract people. If you say, I'm committing to you and your good experience here, it's not it's not enough just to say, oh, we want to hire a woman. You know, I get requests all the time. Hey, I'd love to hire a woman. It's like, oh, I'm the woman factory. Okay, how do I know that this woman is going to have a good experience within your company culture, and that they're going to be nurtured and protected the way, you know, that men are? And I think that, so you want to send a strong signal, and Etsy sent a really strong signal, and slowly but surely things are changing. But, you know, I mean, I have to hand it to Trey, this studies like this really moves the needle powerfully.
Isn't there also the Grace Hopper Women in Computing Convention? Is that well attended?
Yeah, it's attended great, but there, you know, not without controversy. It was a year and a half ago that Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, put his foot in his mouth by talking about how women should just wait to be recognized. Like, just wait there, you know, don't be too pushy. Someone will recognize you eventually if you've earned it.
Well,
that was the subtext.
Trey, your survey reported that 66% of women felt excluded from social networking events. What do you think is responsible for that?
So well, there are a couple of interesting data points. There's the 66 being excluded from key networking opportunities, and then there's the 60% who believe they've not had the same job opportunities as men in their profession. And I think we sort of hit on this earlier, but the networking opportunities are the, you know, it's the lunches at Hooters. It's the guys hanging out in the hot tub at the end of the day. And there are things like that that tend to be a bit exclusionary, but I think for me the one that was most disturbing was that, you know, not being given that big project or feeling that you're missing out on that big opportunity because of your gender. That is, again, one of those, you know, missing one or two projects early in your career puts you on a very different trajectory.
I've heard a couple I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, keep going.
I was just gonna say, I remember hearing going to sort of panels or whatever, the, you know, when investors would talk about how they decided who they want to invest in, you know, you hear the trope, like, just someone that I'd really want to roll up my sleeves in a boardroom with at 2 a.m. when the chips are down. Like that, it's the tech industry equivalent of, you know, they just seem like someone I could grab a beer with. So you know, when you have sort of amorphous criteria like that, someone who I would be comfortable working late with, it does exclude people who, you know, you don't feel like you want to be comfortable with.
And you've cleared up a lot for me. I've never been to a Hooters, and maybe that's why I'm not a broadcast executive.
Well, I will say, so I don't know anything about Hooters luncheons, but for example,
that was one of the examples,
it's not one
just
I would
joking.
Clamor to join, but I will say that one of the areas of push that I have is for representation on speaking panels and at conferences. And so these conferences often have VIP dinners. And if the slate of speakers is mostly men, then mostly men get these chummy VIP dinners.
My thanks to both. Go ahead, Trey. We're really out of time, but if you have an important point to make.
No. I think that's a great place to end it.
Rachel Sklar is a writer, tech entrepreneur, co-founder of The List, which grew out of the Change the Ratio, which she founded. And Trey Vassallo is an engineer and investor, and she created the survey Elephant in the Valley that inspired this conversation. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you. And please add your voice at elephantinthevalley.com.